We will begin our afternoon's address with the singing of hymn number 87. And this is selected by our brother Neville. And accompanying us this afternoon is Sister Robin Phillips of the Echo Lake, New Jersey Ecclesia, and I'm Brother Stephen Robinson of Pittsburgh. And after singing this hymn, Brother Josh Hodge will give us an opening word of prayer. Alleluia, raise, O raise, to our God the song of praise, hymn number 87.
Yahweh, our God and our Father, great is thy name in all the earth, and greatly to be praised. We approach unto thee now to praise thee, to honor thy great name, for thou art the one true God in heaven and earth, and there is none like unto thee, no, not one. O Father, what a privilege it is for us to be here gathered together as thy servants, as thy vessels, to open thy word of truth, that word which is powerful unto salvation. Help us to learn and to love thy word. Help us to receive it with meekness, that engrafted word which is able to save us. And may the class this afternoon, O Father, help us to draw nigh unto thee, that thou would draw nigh unto us, that our minds might be on that which is above and not on the earth beneath. Father, may we be encouraged. May we be encouraged by thy word. May we be encouraged by one another. May we help one another to walk that walk towards the kingdom, to take up our crosses and to follow thy Son, who lived that perfect life in dedication to thee. And so we thank thee for all things and commend this afternoon hour into thy hand. In the name of thy Son, the Lord Jesus Christ. Amen.
As an introduction to our brother Neville's class, which is his first class, on his theme, Zechariah Prophecies for the Last Days, he's asked us to read from Ezra chapter 3. And this will be read to us by Brother Scott McFarlane of the book Rhode Ecclesia.
Reading together from Ezra chapter 3. And when the seventh month was come, and the children of Israel were in the cities, the people gathered themselves together as one man to Jerusalem. Then stood up to Joshua, the son of Jozadak, his brethren, the priests, and Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and his brethren, and builded the altar of God of Israel, to offer burnt offerings thereon, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. And they set the altar upon his bases, for fear was upon them, because of the people of those countries, and they offered burnt offerings thereon unto the Lord, even burnt offerings morning and evening. And they kept also the Feast of Tabernacles, as it is written, and offered the daily burnt offerings by number according to the custom, as the duty of every day required. And afterward offered the continual burnt offering, both of the new moons and of all set feasts of the Lord that were consecrated, and of every one that willingly offered a freewill offering unto the Lord. From the first day of the seventh month began they to offer burnt offerings unto the Lord. But the foundation of the temple of the Lord was not yet laid. They gave money also unto the masons and to the carpenters, and meat and drink and oil unto them in Zidon and to them in Tyre, to bring cedar trees from Lebanon to the Sea of Joppa, according to the grant that they had of Cyrus, king of Persia. Now in the second year of their coming unto the house of God at Jerusalem, in the second month began Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, and the remnant of their brethren in the priests and the Levites, and all they that were come out of captivity unto Jerusalem, and appointed the Levites from 20 years old and upward to set forward the work of the house of the Lord. Then stood Jeshua and with his sons and his brethren, Kadmiel and his sons, the sons of Judah, together to set forward the workmen in the house of God, the sons of Hedad, with their sons and their brethren, the Levites. And when the builders laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, they set the priests in their apparel and trumpets, and Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals to praise the Lord after the ordinance of David, king of Israel. And they sang together by chorus in praising and giving thanks unto the Lord, because he is good, for his mercy endureth forever toward Israel. And all the people shouted with a great shout when they praised the Lord, because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. But many of the priests and Levites and chief of the fathers, who were ancient men that had seen the first house when the foundation of the house was laid before their eyes, wept with a loud voice, and many shouted aloud for joy, so that the people could not discern the noise of the shout of joy from the noise of the weeping of the people. For the people shouted with a loud shout, and the noise was heard afar off.
This afternoon we have Brother Neville Clark of the Tea Tree Gully, South Australia Ecclesia. Brother Neville's talk this afternoon is the first of his adult classes on the theme, Zechariah, Prophecies for the Last Day. The title of his talk is, They Built the House of Yahweh. Brother Neville.
Well, thank you, Brother Chairman, and good afternoon, my dearly loved brethren and sisters and our dear young people. Well, we come, as our chairman has said this afternoon, to the first of our main studies on the prophecy of Zechariah. And this afternoon we're going to simply look at the background to the prophecy, the times in which the prophecy was given, and the immediate application to the people of those times, the structure of the prophecy, meet the man, Zechariah himself. These are the days, of course, about 530 BC, when a small band of captives had returned from Babylonian captivity in the early days of the Persian Empire back to Judah to recolonize the land and to reestablish upon that land a nation of Israel. And you might ask me, well, that's all very well, but how are these words going to be relevant to us? Oh yes, perhaps the latter chapters of the prophecy we know well from our own public lectures relate to the Battle of Armageddon and the events surrounding that, but really, what of the rest of the prophecy, particularly the early chapters which had their main application some 2,500 years ago? Well, remember the comment we made last night that here was a group of people that had returned from Babylonian captivity back to the land of Judah. They returned because they were faithful. And they thought they had learned a lesson which their fathers had forgotten, that you couldn't lightly tread the commandments of God underfoot. You couldn't play fast and loose with the things of the truth and expect that God would be indifferent to that. Well, they return thinking, therefore, that they'd never go into captivity again because they'd learned the lessons of their fathers and that the temple that they were building would never be destroyed again. Well, how wrong they were. Not only would that temple be destroyed again, the very prophets that lived in Zechariah's day said that it would be destroyed again. Even before that temple had commenced building, prophecies were being given to say that it too would be destroyed again, that there would be another captivity, and that this time millions would die. The point being, they wouldn't really learn the lessons of their fathers at all. Those Jews of that generation that had returned from captivity. And my point to you, brothers and sisters, and in fact to us, is that it's no different for us in our days in the times of the Gentiles. Britain is about to leave the European Union. We've been waiting for that event to happen for 40 years, since 1973, when Britain first entered the EU against what we expected should happen. Therefore, when she goes in, we know that she must come out. And Theresa May, as you know, thought an evil thought and said, well, the time elapsing in my tenure isn't long enough. Perhaps I'll have another election and get the full term. Well, that blew up on her face, didn't it? Only it appears most likely to fulfill further prophecy, which would require Britain to be more right-wing, less prone to Catholic aspirations in Europe. So the government that she might have had a couple of months ago will be different to the government that goes forward and makes the final Brexit, because she's now got a coalition with people who like Europe even less, most probably, than she does. So even though Britain, the Tories win the election, God still tweaks that victory. 40 years we've been waiting for that to happen. Israel now, it appears, has approval from the US to form a one-state solution in the land. Donald Trump, unlike Barack Obama, approves a one-state solution. Forget about negotiations with the Palestinians. They're a thorn in your side. Pursue a one-state solution. We've been waiting for that for 70 years, since 1948, because Ezekiel 38 says that Gog comes down upon the mountains of Israel, which are in Israeli control. That's the West Bank. She's got to control the West Bank. She's got to own the West Bank before Armageddon occurs. She won't own Gaza, by the way. She flies upon the shoulders of the Philistines, Isaiah 11 says, after Christ returns. But she'll own the West Bank beforehand. 70 years. We've been waiting for that. And Russia's in the Middle East. Never underestimate the significance of that. Russia's in the Middle East. We've been waiting for that for 500 years since the fall of Constantinople in 1453 and the migration of the Christian population of Constantinople up to Moscow, making Moscow the third Rome. Can you wonder why Vladimir Putin wants to take the ancient sacred cathedral in Istanbul back to himself again and reform Justinian's Eastern Roman Empire? So the headlines are screaming at us. History is screaming at us. Bible prophecy is screaming at us. But despite that, when Christ actually does return to us, the Brotherhood will be in its weakest position since its inception in the days of Brother Thomas. Can you believe it? What do you think the doctor would be saying today if he was watching world headlines? What goes wrong? Well, the love of money comes upon us, you see. 1 Timothy 6, verse 10, your margin will tell you, says that the love of money will seduce people from the truth. Olivet Prophecy, Luke 21, verse 34, people will be overtaken by the cares of this life. Matthew 24, verse 12, the Olivet Prophecy in Matthew's record, the love of many shall wax cold. The point is that the events that prophecy speaks of at the end of the age are the same at the end of every age. And it doesn't really matter whether it's the end of the Commonwealth of Judah or the end of the age of the Gentiles. There is an enormous spiritual decline prior to the conclusion of that epoch. It will be no different for us, despite the signs of the times. How can it happen? Because we will say in our hearts, we have Abraham for our father, and we're never in bondage to any man. And that God has cast off the natural branches and he's grafted us in, he won't do it to us. Well, think again. If he did it to the natural branches, Paul says, what do you think he will do if the wild branches boast themselves like the natural branches did? But flesh is flesh, you see. Do you suppose, brothers and sisters and young people, that just because we're Christadelphians, God will overlook our apathy, our indifference, our laziness, our lack of attention to spiritual things, and accept us anyway? Do you suppose that will happen? It didn't happen with his own people. That's the lesson of Zechariah, you see. That will be the lesson of Zechariah. But there, of course, is a hope. All down through time, there has always been a remnant. There was a remnant in Jewry. There will also be a remnant in Christadelphia. Not every Christadelphian is going to be saved, any more than every Jew would be saved. But let me speak frankly. Remnants are different to most of their contemporaries. If you plan to be in the remnant that is saved, then you're probably not going to want to follow the general downward drift of the rest of Christadelphia. If you believe me that there is a downward drift, if you believe me that Bible study is happening less and less in our community, if you plan to be in the remnant, you'll look for good reasons to make changes in your ecclesias. You want to see a biblical reason for this or that change. And if you're going to depart from the traditions of previous generations, you'll want to have a good reason why that departure is an improvement, why it improves the environment, why it's going to assist your young people to get baptized. You'd need to see good reasons for that, not just to acquiesce to perhaps what the majority wants. I'm saying think hard about these things, because the way I read my Bible, the end of our age is going to be no different to the end of any other age, and it will not be a pinnacle of spirituality in the world, in the brotherhood, when Christ returns. All right, I've said it, but I firmly believe that, and I don't think we can think about that too seriously. We might wonder, you know, why we're given such a large record of the times of Zechariah in the biblical record. We've got a number of prophets and historical books all speaking about the times in which Zechariah lived, those times of and about the return from Babylonian captivity. I'm speaking, of course, of Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Haggai, Zechariah. There's a large section of scripture surrounding this particular epoch of time, far larger, for example, than you have about the days of Solomon, when the nation's kingdom was at its greatest. I mean, the golden years of national Israel. Well, the answer to that question, I think, is in the reality of every situation in mankind. The times when kingdoms reach their pinnacle are relatively few and far between, and also relatively short-lived. Solomon had peace with all his neighbours. He had a magnificent kingdom, an enormous income, there was great building, there was prosperity, a state of almost unmixed blessing whilst he ruled. But as we turn the pages of Zechariah, we find a very, very different picture. We have a time in scriptural terms called a day of small things. That's what Zechariah chapter 4 speaks of. His day, the temple they were building, was a day of small things. In comparison to Solomon's day, which was a day of big things, you see. A struggle against opposition from within the ecclesia, opposition from without the ecclesia, apathy and indifference within the ecclesia. A far cry, you might say, from the things of Solomon's kingdom. A day of beginnings. And my point is that that is the reality of ecclesial life. Every generation is a day of small things. It's not a day of big things until Christ comes. And therefore we've got a lot of chapters, a lot of books of the Bible devoted to this particular epoch of history, because that's the reality every generation finds themselves confronting. And that's important, you know, because it's in the day of small things that the servants are really tested. He that is faithful in little, Jesus said, will I make faithful in much. I'll make him ruler over much. But that process begins, of course, by being faithful over little. We're going to find as we look at Zechariah together that in exactly the same way as Zechariah and Haggai and those with them built the temple all those years ago, we also are building a temple. Not a temple of stones, but a temple of people. It's a day of small things. We're talking about mortal people, prone to the nature we all bear. Not necessarily easy. Not easy to rub the rough corners off these stones. But we're building nevertheless. And as they built on the foundation of Solomon, we're building upon the foundation of the greater than Solomon. And as prophet and priest labored together, putting stone upon stone, firstly building an altar, then building a foundation, and then finally erecting a temple, we also, says the Apostle Peter, are living stones built up into a spiritual house. You see, we're building our own temple in exactly the same way as they built a temple back in the days of Zechariah. As every builder knows, every temple begins as a day of small things. And that's why the Bible contains this record. So let's begin with the history. Where are we in time? Well, you know, of almost any prophecy in the Bible, Zechariah is one of the easiest to date of all. I mean, there's very little debate about the historical record, about the dating of the years of the Persian kings. We're left in almost no doubt whatsoever as to when Zechariah prophesied. In 606 BC, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, attacked Jerusalem for the first time and took many captives. Those captives were the aristocracy of the nation, and they included Daniel and his three friends in 606 BC. Jeremiah, in Jeremiah chapter 29, prophesied at that time that when that captivity would occur, it would last for 70 years, and that therefore, as they would soon know, in 536 BC, those captives would return. At least the first band of captives would return from what would become then Persian domination back to the land of Israel. So therefore in 536 BC, Cyrus, the king of Persia, who had recently inherited his empire from Babylon, made the decree for the Jews to return, and it happened in exactly the right year. Well, in 586 BC, 20 years after his first invasion, Nebuchadnezzar took another captivity and destroyed Solomon's temple. And that date, 586, began another 70-year epoch, the 70 years destruction of the temple. And you can see on the screen there, we have between 606 and 536 BC, 70 years of Jewish captivity. And we have between 586 and 516 BC, 70 years destruction of the temple. Two 70-year periods, you see. And that becomes important because, well, think of this. The captives first returned to the land just shortly after 536 BC. The temple, however, would not be built for the best part of another 20 years till 516 BC. But it did not take 20 years to build. And this becomes a major point in the prophecy, you see. It did not take. There was a hiatus. There was a cessation of work for the best part of 15 of those 20 years because of all kinds of complications. And it was only because the prophet Zechariah, or prophets Zechariah and Haggai, got involved that the temple was ever completed in 516 BC. Were it not for them and the instrumentality of their prophecies, it would never have occurred, and certainly not on time. Well, down the bottom of the screen, you can see in those yellow boxes there the references we have to Ezra chapter 1, Ezra chapter 3, all the way through the prophecies of Haggai and Zechariah. And I just draw your attention to the fact, 536, we have Cyrus's decree to return. That's Ezra chapter 1, all the way through to Ezra chapter 3. 535, 1 year later, we've got the foundation of the temple laid. You just read that in Ezra chapter 3, verse 8. 520 BC, 15 years later, after work had ceased on the temple, Zechariah comes in, Haggai comes in and provokes the people to start working once more. And then 4 years later, by 516 BC, as we're told in Ezra chapter 6 and verse 15, the temple is finally completed. So that's where Zechariah fits in with Haggai, with Ezra, in the early years, as I say, of the Persian Empire. Now come with me to Daniel chapter 9. Because, of course, Daniel's prophesying at this very time, or just slightly before this very time, and he's also done calculations about the 70-year period, or one of the 70-year periods that we've just spoken of. And it tells us in Daniel 9 and in verse 1, in the first year of Darius, now this is Darius the Mede, the first of the Persian kings, the father-in-law to Cyrus the Great, that Cyrus who made the decree to return. In the first year of Darius the Mede, the son of Ahasuerus, of the seed of the Medes, which was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood by books the number of the years whereof the word of Yahweh came to Jeremiah the prophet that he would accomplish 70 years in the desolations of Jerusalem. Now think about that. Here's a man in Daniel who has spent a lifetime in captivity. He's something like 90 years old here in Daniel chapter 9. He went to Babylon as a young man, as a youth, and he's been studying prophecy. And as the scrolls of Jeremiah were unrolled from the pen of that writer and made their way to Babylon, you remember Jeremiah was in Jerusalem, Daniel would be eagerly digesting everything his contemporary prophet wrote. And despite the fact that your margin says Jeremiah 25, I believe this is a reference to Jeremiah 29 and verse 10, he's going through the prophecy of Jeremiah 29 and he's spotted the 70 years and he's doing the calculations and they're nearing the year 536 BC and Daniel is saying, we've got to return. The 70 years from when Nebuchadnezzar took the first captivity has almost elapsed and any time soon we've got to have a decree to return and Daniel's calculating that in verse 2 of Daniel chapter 9. Well, of course, Daniel was very senior in the Persian Empire, having been promoted by the Babylonians remarkably because of the excellent spirit that the record in Daniel ascribes to Daniel, the Persians also accept him into their empire as an extremely senior public servant. Daniel therefore knew King Cyrus personally. And if Daniel is calculating the year that the Jews ought to return from captivity, do you suppose that he would have told Daniel chapter 9 verse 2 to Cyrus? Well, of course he would. He was at the guest at the table of the king of the greatest empire of the world at the time. And only 150 years earlier, Isaiah had prophesied in Isaiah 44 and verse 28 that Yahweh said of Cyrus, he is my shepherd. He shall perform all my pleasure, even saying to Jerusalem, there shall be built, and to the temple, thy foundation shall be laid. Do you suppose that Daniel showed Cyrus the Isaiah scroll of Isaiah 44? I expect it's almost certain that he would have showed him that. Because any time soon, Daniel 9 says, That decree has got to be given for the Jews to return. And Cyrus has got to know that the God of Israel has included him by name 150 years earlier in prophecy. Why wouldn't you show that to the monarch of the empire of the world, who you knew personally, whose table you dined at? Why wouldn't you show that? Of course you would. Well, it's not long before that decree is given. On time, you can read of it in Ezra chapter 6. It tells us in Ezra chapter 6 that Cyrus said, let the house be builded, the place where they offered sacrifices. Let the foundations thereof be strongly laid, and the height thereof 70 cubits. Cyrus knows the dimensions of Solomon's temple. He starts to repeat them and says, here's money from the Persian treasury. Go and buy building materials and rebuild a temple and take back as many of my empire who would like to go. And the decree is made. And the Jews go back under Zerubbabel, in fact, in Ezra chapter 1 and 2. But as Daniel's studying these prophecies of Jeremiah in Daniel chapter 9, that's not all he finds out. You come across the page to Daniel 9 and verse 26. Daniel makes a great prayer in chapter 9 on behalf of his people, and he prays for God to work events such that the decree might be made to return. But in verse 26 of Daniel 9, this is what he's told. And after 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself, that is, not for anything he's done. And the people of the prince, the Roman army as it would turn out to be, shall come and shall destroy that city, Jerusalem, and the sanctuary, the temple. And the end thereof shall be with a flood, and unto the end of the war desolations are determined. So the very day that Daniel distills the 70-year prophecy of Jeremiah that the Jews shall return shows Cyrus the decree from Isaiah 44 that a temple should be rebuilt. He's told that that temple would be destroyed. That's my point, you see. Even before work had begun, prophecies were saying that this temple's got a limited life. It's going to be here for a purpose, and it's going to go because your people will never learn the lesson. Not till Messiah finally comes the second time will they ever learn to serve me, says God. And therefore that temple you're going to go and build is only going to last, as it turned out, for about 500 years. Well, the exiles return. Come with me now to Ezra chapter 3. What, by the way, would be the point of building the temple then, do you suppose? If we're only going to build a temple to have it destroyed in 500 years, why build the temple at all? Why even make the decree? Why send the people back to build the thing? Well, because building a temple is not just about laying stone upon stone. It's about building people, isn't it? Why build an ecclesial hall, brothers and sisters, when you know, for example, that Christ is going to come and will be destroyed? Well, because it's in the cooperation we have together in building things in ecclesial life that builds people, that changes characters. So even if the temple's got a limited life, there's still value in building the temple. No matter what we do in ecclesial life, it's got a limited life. It might only even last for our generation. There's still value in building it because building builds people. It develops consciences. It elicits expectations. And it unites people together around the things of the truth and focuses their minds on the priorities of life. There's always value in building, even if you're only building small things, you see. Well, the exiles returned. Ezra chapter 3. I didn't even turn there myself. Ezra chapter 3. Barely 50,000 of them, by the way, as you find out from Ezra chapter 2. Men, women, children, a few animals. What did they come back to? What was there in Israel when these captives finally got back there? What was there in Judah? Well, the answer is that there wasn't much. Even before Judah went into captivity, Assyria had come and destroyed all of the northern kingdom. They'd taken every city in the northern kingdom and depopulated those Jews from the northern kingdom of Israel into Assyria. They had replaced them with a whole lot of mixed people, which we know today as the Samaritans. All of them highly superstitious, worshipping, as Jesus says, they know not what. That was what was in the north. They were the people that greeted the returning captives when they finally got back to Judah. The Samaritans had populated the land. Those Samaritans, of course, had a smattering of the truth because one of the priests was sent back by the Assyrians to teach them how to worship the God of the land so that the lions didn't attack them, you'll remember. And all that did for the Samaritans was add Yahweh to the host of deities they already worshipped. The place was run down. There was no industry. There was no great urban development. It was full of wide open spaces which were occupied by a people hostile to the Jewish cause. That's what the captives found when they finally got back to the land. So what did Israel do? They get back 50,000 people, defenseless people, men, women, children. They finally migrate back to where Jerusalem had been, planning to rebuild things. What did they do? Well, what would you do? Well, the first thing I'd be wanting to talk about is a wall. A wall. Because we're going to need protection, aren't we? Oh, it's all right for you and for me and perhaps other brethren. What about our wives? And what about our children? What about our young children? I mean, look at the people around about it. They hate us already. And they resent the fact that we've come back into a land after 70 years, which they thought they'd inherited forever. I'd want to build a wall. Well, they don't build a wall, do they? They had very different priorities. Ezra chapter 3, verse 1. When the seventh month was come, and the children of Israel were in the cities, the people gathered themselves together as one man to Jerusalem. One man, so they're united. They're a faithful bunch that have come back. Then stood up Joshua the son of Jozadak and his brethren the priests, and Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel and his brethren, and they builded the altar of God of the God of Israel to offer burnt offerings thereon, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. The first thing they do is they build an altar. The second thing you're going to find they do is they build a foundation for the temple. The third thing they do is build the temple upon that foundation. Only in the days of Nehemiah do they finally build a wall. I mean, think about that for priorities and the truth. They had their priorities right, didn't they? They had it exactly right. God was at the centre and God would defend them. Now, it didn't altogether go well, but that nevertheless was the right approach to the recolonization of the land. The truth at the centre and the truth first, not man-made defences. Do you know, think about this, in Nehemiah chapter 8, well, Nehemiah chapter 6, they finish the wall. In Nehemiah chapter 8, they get Ezra up to read the law, which he does on the platform of wood that it tells us, or the pulpit of wood in Nehemiah chapter 8. And what does Nehemiah tell the people to do? They've just read the law. They've finished the wall a couple of chapters earlier. He says, now go and celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles, which would require them to go out and live under little dwellings of sticks. Why? Well, because they've just built a wall. And the last thing Nehemiah wants is for them to take reliance in that wall for defense. So go out and celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles, he says, so that you know where your real defense comes from. Because if God's not on your side, a wall won't help you. That's the point here, you see. The altar goes down first. So the first course of defense is to develop your relationship with God. And that's exactly what's happened here. And here the Jews are, no doubt, looking this way and that, watching people moving in the shadows, climbing from behind that bush, weapons being brandished all around them from this hostile people, but they nevertheless build the altar first. They thought about building a wall. They thought long and hard about building a wall. How do we know? Because in Zechariah chapter 3, you have a vision of a man with a measuring line who set out to measure the confines of the city of Jerusalem. Why was he measuring Jerusalem in Zechariah chapter 3? Well, we're not told. Well, we are, by implication. Zechariah is told to go and stop that man. Why? Because God says, because I'll be a wall of fire round about Jerusalem. You know exactly, therefore, why they were measuring Jerusalem. So yes, there were a group of people building that altar. There was another group working out how much stone would be required to build that wall and how big it should be. And they were told to stop doing it, which, to their credit, they did. And you can read of that by implication in Zechariah chapter 3. Well, verse 8 of Ezra chapter 3, the second year. They've got the altar down toward the end of the first year, and it says, and in the second year of their coming unto the house of God at Jerusalem, in the second month began Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua the son of Jozadak, and the remnant of their brethren, the priests and the Levites, and all they that were come out of the captivity unto Jerusalem, They appointed the Levites from 20 years old and upward to set forward the work of the house of Yahweh. Now they begin to build the temple. What that means is that they're going to first lay, if you like, a big slab of concrete. They're going to lay a foundation upon which they can build that temple. So down goes the foundation, you see, of, let's call it, Zerubbabel's temple. And now for the first time since the work began, for the first time since those colonists return, they can see the end in sight. And all of a sudden it dawns upon them that they really are re-establishing a nation. I mean, this is almost like the foundation of the ecclesial hall. And this has got an enormous power, you see, to unite these people around that altar which they built at the end of the previous year. And so they open up their Bibles once this work begins. They open up their Bibles and say, well, what should we do to celebrate the progress of the work begun? And it tells us in verse 10 that when the builders laid the foundation of the temple of Yahweh, they set the priests in their apparel with trumpets, and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals to praise Yahweh after the ordinance of David, the king of Israel. This, you see, was the reality of their dreams. Now look, all they've done is they've laid a foundation. They haven't yet built the temple. But as far as they're concerned, it's as good as done. The foundation's there. They can see the dimensions of this thing. All they're going to do is put up walls and a roof. And therefore, at this particular juncture in the building project, they cease, they sweep the whole thing clean, and they're about to have a celebration, as if the temple's already finished. They're about to have a celebration of this work that has already begun. And it tells you here that they praised Yahweh at the end of verse 10, after the ordinance of David, the king of Israel. You know, there was more to this than just the ordinance of David, the king of Israel. In Solomon's day, you see, it tells us in 1 Chronicles 23, verses 3 and 4, that the Levites were numbered from the age of 30 years and upward, of which 24,000 were to set forward the work of the house of Yahweh. And you see that precise phrase, I'm quoting you, 2 Chronicles 23, verse 4. That precise phrase occurs at the end of Ezra 3, verse 8. To set forward the work of the house of Yahweh. They can see themselves copying precisely what Solomon did when he commenced building his temple, which Nebuchadnezzar destroyed 70-odd years ago. Well, the temple was finally completed in Solomon's day, and it tells us in 2 Chronicles chapter 5 that when the temple was finally completed, they had a great celebration, an enormous celebration. And in 2 Chronicles 5 and verse 12, it says that the Levites, which were singers, all of them, Asaph, Heman, Jeduthun, being arrayed in white linen and having cymbals, stood at the east end of the altar, with them 120 priests sounding with trumpets. So when Solomon's temple was completed and about to be inaugurated, there was an enormous celebration which is recorded for us in 2 Chronicles chapter 5. Can you see that that is directly referred to in verse 10 of Ezra chapter 3. They set the priests in their apparel with trumpets and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals. They're doing it right here in verse 10. But the point is that Solomon is doing this in 2 Chronicles 5 at the completion of his temple. They're doing it at the completion of the foundation of the temple. So you can see what's in their minds. As far as they're concerned, it's as good as done, and they're copying Solomon's celebration, the enormous celebration he had when he completed the temple. And then in 2 Chronicles 5, verse 13, it came to pass, as the trumpeters and singers were as one, they praised Yahweh, saying, "For he is good, for his mercy endureth forever." And look at verse 11 of Ezra 3. They sang together by course, praising and giving thanks unto Yahweh, because he is good, for his mercy endureth forever toward Israel. So no question, you see, about what's happening here. They're copying the festivities of Solomon at the completion of Solomon's temple. All they've done is laid the foundation, but as I say, it's as good as done in their minds. They can see the revival of their dreams in bricks and mortar. And it's a very small step, having now laid the slab, a very small step to see walls and a roof go upon this thing. And such, you see, was the unity of the people in doing this, that there's no question at the quality of the celebration they would have when, at this point, the foundation was laid. Well, the record goes on in verse 12, and it tells us this of Ezra 3. But many of the priests and Levites and chief of the fathers, who were ancient men that had seen the first house, that is, that had seen Solomon's temple, when the foundation of this house was laid before their eyes, wept with a loud voice, and many shouted for joy. So, verse 13, that the people could not discern the noise of the shout of joy from the noise of the weeping of the people. For the people shouted with a loud shout, and the noise was heard afar off. So ringing around the hills surrounding Jerusalem was the chorus of 50,000 people in acclamation as the celebration of this foundation continued. And the noise, it says at the end of verse 13, was heard afar off. And you might make the verbal link between verse 13 of chapter 3 and verse 1 of chapter 4. The noise was heard afar off. Now when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the children of the captivity builded the temple, well then they came to Zerubbabel and said, we'd like to help, in verse 2 of chapter 4. Now what would you say to that? So you've just commenced the work of the temple, and the Samaritans all round about you, who have some knowledge of your God, who have copies of your Bible, they say that they'd want to participate in this and they'd like to help. Well, they come to you and they say, well, you know, since the Assyrian invasion, we've been Christadelphians too. Oh, we don't call ourselves Christadelphians, we're just Christians. And we don't restrict our worship to the worship of Yahweh. We're more broad-minded than that, but we know exactly what you're up to, and we'd like to support that work. Well, Zerubbabel won't have any of it, of course. He sees through this thin veneer of the offer of assistance from the Samaritans. He knows all they want to do is pour cold water upon this work and stop it. Now we know that that was their intention, because when they are declined, verse 4 and 5 of chapter 4 tells us that the people of the land weakened the hands of the people of Judah and troubled them in the building, even hiring counselors against them. So there was nothing good, there was nothing altruistic or honest about the offer of assistance from the Samaritans. The opposition, in fact, was instant, and it was fierce. And it would begin with criticism of what the Jews were doing, and it would escalate to threats, probably intimidation. Eventually, they hire professional counselors against the Jews to try and stop this building work and leave it as just a foundation. And the Samaritans were successful. Not just for a year or two, they were successful for 15 more years. So we've laid the foundation here in 535 BC, in the second year after their return from captivity. We're not going to recommence building of the temple until 520 BC, when Zechariah and Haggai get personally involved. So for 15 years, the Samaritans stop all ecclesial progress, by intimidating the Jews to stop work. Now, why would they do that? I mean, let's be honest, it's hardly as though there's no room for population in the land. I mean, the Jews and the Samaritans could have coexisted side by side without even seeing each other from one hilltop to the next. I mean, it wasn't that populous. What was the issue that the Samaritans had? Well, they had a mighty big issue, you see. At the completion of Solomon's temple, Solomon held a great feast of dedication. He brings up the ark to the temple, and he offers his great prayer in 1 Kings chapter 8. Sacrifices 120,000 sheep. He had a great feast of dedication that lasted 14 days. And it says in 1 Kings 8 and verse 65 that at that time Solomon held a feast, and all Israel with him, a great congregation from the entering in of Hamath to the river of Egypt. So from the uttermost parts of the north to the uttermost parts of the south of Solomon's enormous governed territory. All people involved in that territory were included in this feast. In the next chapter, in 1 Kings 9, it tells us that some of Solomon's governmental policies were given. One of them was this. 1 Kings 9, verse 20. And all the people that were left, which were not of the children of Israel, that is all the Gentiles living under Solomon's control, whom the children of Israel were not able to utterly destroy, upon those did Solomon levy a tribute of bond service until this day. So he enslaved the Gentiles. That's what Solomon did. He enslaved the Gentiles to assist him in the completion of his enormous list of building projects. Well, in time, of course, Solomon died and years went by. The mighty colossus of Assyria comes, arises the north, down she comes, takes the northern kingdom into captivity and replaces the Jews with the Samaritans. Where'd the Samaritans come from? 2 Kings 17, verse 24. The king of Assyria brought men from Babylon, from Kuthath, from Arva, from Hamath, from Sepharvaim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel. Now that's interesting because there were men of Hamath that the Assyrians brought in to occupy the northern half of Israel. Hamath at one time was controlled by Solomon and enslaved by him after the completion of his temple. Can you see the problem? These Samaritans know their history as well as you and I know ours. And they can see, as the foundation has gone down, the day coming when we have a restored Judah which wants once again to enslave Gentiles. And they won't have a bar of it. And they're going to do everything they can, therefore, to stop the building of this temple and to stop the progress of a resurrected Judah in the land of Israel. Not interested. Not interested at all. Well, that was one problem. And that's what motivated the Samaritans. Whilst that's bad enough, it wasn't just the Samaritans that stopped the building. Did you notice in chapter 3 and verse 12 of Ezra, another problem? Many of the priests and Levites and chief of the fathers who were ancient men that had seen the first house, Solomon's temple, when the foundation of this house was laid before their eyes, they wept with a loud voice, and many shouted aloud for joy. And then it goes on in verse 13, so the people could not discern the noise of the shout of joy from the weeping of the people. We've got a problem in the ecclesia, don't we? Not only was there opposition from without, staunch opposition from without, which was successful, but there was disappointment and apathy from within. And the disappointment of apathy was characterized between the generations. The old men compared the foundation that they had just laid with the foundation that Solomon laid, and they were comparing what this house was going to be to the former house, and they said, well, we're building a temple, sure, but it's not going to be as good as Solomon's temple. And they burst into tears at that and said, well, what are we doing? We're not resurrecting the empire at all, really. We might as well be building the thing out of cardboard. What kind of a temple is this? And they pour cold water upon the entire project. But there was another generation. The young men here. They hadn't seen Solomon's temple. They'd been born in captivity. And they had gone back to Judah. And they'd begun the greatest building project of their lives. And it didn't care if they'd built this thing out of matchwood. They wanted a temple and they were going to have a temple. So that there was a great shout of joy from the younger generation, and a great weep of commiseration from the older generation, both looking at the same foundation, both contemplating the completion of the same temple. And one viewed that with enormous joy, and the other viewed that with enormous disappointment. And we've got a conflict between the generations and the ecclesia over the same ecclesial work, you see. And if that's the state of your ecclesia, and then you've got opposition, Samaritan opposition from without, well, I'm sorry, you're sunk, aren't you? You are sunk. They began as one man and they put up the altar, no problem. They continued as one man and they built the foundation, no problem. But then they stood back and looked at that, and one group jumped for joy and the other group burst into tears when they realized what the completion would look like. That destroyed the unity of the ecclesia, and therefore the Samaritans were all over them like a rash and completely stopped any further ecclesial development for the next 15 years. My word, brothers and sisters, if that's not an exhortation to unity, what is? Because as the world assaults ecclesial life, if we are not united in our purpose, even in our devotion to small things, we'll completely drop the ball and lose the game. Because the world is extremely powerful. And if, would you believe, for example, that the Samaritans would have fostered that conflict within the ecclesia? Of course they would have. They would use any trick they could to stop that work. And they were successful, as chapter 4, verses 4 and 5 tells you. Unbelievable. But let me tell you this. If this was to happen in your ecclesia, and perhaps a great building project of some kind, be it a physical or a spiritual building project, whatever it might be, if some great initiative was begun, perhaps there's a reformation, let's just make this up. There's a reformation and you're going to get back to the traditions of your fathers and you're going to recreate the ecclesia like it was in the old days. But there's only one of the generations in your ecclesia that remembers how things were. Maybe you're going to start a magazine, whatever it might be. And one generation says, well, it's not as good as it used to be. And the younger generation says, this is the greatest thing we've ever seen in our lives in the truth. And the ecclesia is not united about that. And the world outside is pushing harder and harder into the ecclesia. What's going to happen? Well, it's going to all fall over. All right, and when it falls over, what will your ecclesial members do? Will they just, sit on their chairs and just watch the world go by? No, that's not real life. What will they do? I'll show you what they did. For 15 years. Come with me to Haggai chapter 1. Nothing stands still, including people. And all of a sudden we've said, all right, well, we've begun a preaching effort. We didn't get anybody to the first lecture. It was a great lecture, but nobody came. This is hopeless. The former generation says, well, it was never like this in the old days. The younger generation says, we've begun a great preaching work into a new area of our city. The ecclesia is disunited. The whole work sort of runs out of puff. So we stop preaching. What does the ecclesia then do? Do they do nothing? No, they do not do nothing. This is what the ecclesia did in Zechariah's day. Haggai, who's a contemporary of Zechariah, as I'll show you shortly, Haggai chapter 1, verse 4. Is it a time for you, O ye that dwell in your sealed houses? The word sealed means panelled. Your sealed houses, and this house is lie waste. Now, therefore, thus saith Yahweh of armies, consider your ways, says Haggai. Now, what was happening? Well, of course, they had an enormous amount of building materials that were being laid up in store for building this new temple. They decided not to build the temple. Bit of a shame, therefore, to let those building materials just go to waste, isn't it? A bit of a shame to let that wood go rotten. Actually, I had a leak in the bathroom last week. I've got to replace the wall. Well, it's all for the truth. I mean, I could panel the wall of the bathroom and then I could have more people over for meals. I mean, pick a reason. So we pilfer the building materials. The building materials, by the way, that Cyrus paid for. We start pilfering those so that we can panel our own houses. So there's what happens. If you're not working in the ecclesia, you're working in your personal life. You're going to work. You're going to do something. And this is what they did, you see. They started building their own houses with the materials that were purchased for the building of the ecclesial hall, of the temple, if you like. They started to use the materials of the truth for their own purposes. Verse 2. Thus speaketh Yahweh of armies, saying, this people say, the time has not come, the time that Yahweh's house should be built. And now they're quoting Bible prophecy to say that we don't actually want the temple to be completed until 516 BC. But it's now 535 BC. Well, we should stop building. We should stop preaching. We should stop doing this ecclesial work. And we should have a bit of our rest and then only commence nearer the time when the second 70-year prophecy is about to be fulfilled. So they have a biblical justification for why they should stop doing this or that work in the ecclesia. And this justification assists them to use the ecclesial materials in their own lives. Well, because of that, they were cursed. You see, look at verse 6. You've sown much and you bring in little. You eat, but you have not enough. You drink, but you're not filled with drink. You clothe you, but there is none warm. And he that earneth wages to put it into a bag with holes. What does that mean? Well, they've justified their actions. And they're stealing the ecclesial building materials and incorporating them into their own lives. They keep making money at a rapacious pace in verse 6, but they never ever seem to get ahead. Inflation's now spiraling out of control. Always another bill comes in. They buy a new car. Oh, it breaks. And how about that? We're just out of warranty, and we leak another $5,000 to fix that problem. And the more they earned, well, it says here, you earn and you earn and you merely put your money into a bag with holes and it's leaking out of your bank account as fast as it's going in, and no matter what you do, you never ever seem to get ahead because God's cursed everything you touch. Everything you touch. You're turning straw into lead. Not only that, verse 11, I called for a drought upon the land and upon the mountains and upon the corn and upon the new wine, upon the oil, upon that which the ground bringeth forth, upon men, upon cattle, upon all the labour of the hands. Even nature was against them. So now you've lost your job. The bills are still going to come in. You've lost your job now. So the bag that you have with holes doesn't even have anything going into it. I mean, you are going to become desperate. And the entire economy, the Jewish economy, of those captives that have returned is now running out of control. Everything's leaking away. So they haven't paid any attention to God's house. He's going to pay no attention to theirs. And the people say to Haggai, well, what can we do, Haggai? What can we do? Now we've got no money. Oh, we had a nice house, but we can't afford to maintain it. Everything's falling down around us. We're spending all our time just to get enough food to eat. How can we possibly do anything? And they go to Haggai and they say, what should we do? And he says, it's simple. Verse 7. Thus saith Yahweh of armies, consider your ways. Go up to the mountain and bring wood. I mean, there's no wood left from Cyrus. Go up to the mountain, he says, and bring wood. And build the house, and I'll take pleasure in it, and I'll be glorified, says Yahweh. Bring wood. Start patching up the holes in your ecclesia. Start building the walls of your ecclesia. It doesn't have to be stone and cedar overlaid with gold. I don't care what it looks like, Haggai says. If your heart's right, if you've got a positive activity in the ecclesia, I'll bless it, says Yahweh, and I'll rejoice in it. And you know, that's the big point of the prophecy of Zechariah. That's why they return from captivity. Not to build a temple, but to build an ecclesia. What use has God got for temples? He doesn't dwell in temples made with hands. He dwells in the hearts of people. So building the physical temple was merely a conduit to assist in the building of the spiritual temple. That was really all it was about, and therefore it didn't matter what it was built from. Of course it wouldn't be as good as Solomon. Cyrus would never ever fund that. But spiritually, it could be equal to Solomon's, you see? And that was the point. And that point is emphasized. Because look at chapter 2 and verse 6 of Haggai. Thus saith Yahweh of armies, yet once it is a little while, and I'll shake the heavens and the earth, and the sea and the dry land. Now that verse is quoted in Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 26, and it leaves us in no doubt as to what that's saying in Haggai chapter 2. The heavens and the earth speak of the Jewish heavens and the earth. That is the government of the kingdom of Judah in the days of the Lord Jesus Christ. The rulers and the citizens of the Mosaic system. And it's going to be shaken to pieces. AD 70 would come. God would wipe out the Mosaic, the Jewish Commonwealth and the Mosaic system. And with it, the temple, this temple that they're building. So even Haggai says on one hand, go and get wood and build this temple. And in the next breath, and I'm going to shake it to pieces in the future, God says. I only ever plan it to be a temporary temple. Exactly what Daniel said in Daniel 9 and verse 26, you see. From the get-go, it was only ever planned to be temporary. Why? Because the real purpose is the building of people, not the building of sticks and stones. Now come with me to Ezra chapter 5. Back to Ezra. All right, so Haggai's got involved. Zechariah, as I show you, is going to get involved. The Samaritans have stopped the work in Ezra chapter 4, but it recommences in Ezra chapter 5 some 15 years later. And Ezra chapter 5 and verse 1 says this: the prophets Haggai the prophet, Zechariah the son of Iddo — this is our Zechariah — Zechariah the son of Iddo prophesied to the Jews that were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel, even unto them. Then rose up Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua the son of Jozadak, and began to build the house of God which is at Jerusalem, and with them were the prophets of God helping them. You see what's happened? So Joshua and Zerubbabel went back with these captives and they started the building work. The ecclesia was divided. The opposition from where outside stopped the building work for 15 years. And God sends in two prophets, Zechariah and Haggai. The people asked Haggai, who I'll show you shortly, was the older of those two prophets, what should we do? He says, get up the mountain and get wood. There's none left here, so get up there and get it and start building the walls. Zechariah says, and don't think about building a wall around this city. Yahweh will be a wall of fire about the city to defend it. You'll be fine if you trust in the God of your fathers. And what's more, we'll help you do it, as it tells you in these first two verses. Zechariah and Haggai assisted Joshua and Zerubbabel and the people to continue work in the temple after, as I say, a 15-year hiatus. It's now 520 BC in Ezra chapter 5 and verse 1. Marvellous picture, you know. Month after month, those prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, spoke to the people, encouraging them, building them so that they in turn could build the temple. The opposition, of course, from the Samaritans was immense. Letters are going back and forth to the crown to stop this building work, to suggest that the Jews are resurrecting an ancient kingdom and that they plan to rebel against their Persian overlords. All of it failed. Ultimately, all of it failed. But as the record implies here, you can see Zechariah and Haggai were contemporaries. And they worked together. There was an overlap in their ministries. They weren't the same age, but their ministries overlapped. And as you put together the record of the prophecy of Zechariah and the prophecy of Haggai, you can see that they work like this. They dovetail like this. So in the second year of Darius — now what was that if I run back here? The second year of Darius, 520 BC. Haggai begins prophesying in Haggai chapter 1, a call to work. Later on the same year, he completes the last four verses of Haggai chapter 1 as another prophecy. The response of the people is recorded. Haggai chapter 2 begins that year. The future glory of the temple, the fact that the temple is going to be destroyed and replaced when the desire of all nations shall come in, the return of Christ. Then Zechariah begins in Zechariah chapter 1, in the second year of Darius, in the eighth month, the first six verses of Zechariah chapter 1. Haggai continues in Haggai chapter 2. There will be immediate blessings if you complete this temple. There will be future blessings if you complete this temple. Then Zechariah launches again in the 24th day of the 11th month of the second year of Darius, and he gives basically Zechariah chapter 1 through 6. 2 years later, Zechariah comes on again, chapters 7 and 8. In the fourth year of Darius. 2 years later, in the sixth year of Darius, 516 BC, Ezra chapter 6, verses 14 and 15, the temple is completed. As a consequence, in large part, of the assistance of those two great prophets, Haggai and Zechariah. But there's the question: how could Haggai and Zechariah provoke the nation into completing that temple when Joshua the high priest and Zerubbabel, the civil leader of the land, could not? What could Zechariah and Haggai do that those other two great men could not do? Well, this is what they could do. They could unite old and young in the ecclesia like that. Haggai, you see, he says in Haggai chapter 2, verse 3, which of you saw this temple in its former glory, and how do you see it now? Now, the only way you could ever say that with any credibility to an ecclesia is if you'd seen that yourself. So it appears that Haggai had seen Solomon's temple. He was a much older man. Consider your ways, therefore, he says. Think hard about what you're doing. Change your lives. Don't think like what you've been telling me. Haggai was an older prophet, and he could speak directly to the older generation. Zechariah, however, his grandfather, Iddo, who we read of in Zechariah 1 verse 1, he returned to the land with Zerubbabel in 536 with the first band of captives that returned. Zechariah's grandfather. So Zechariah was born in the land. Haggai was born in captivity. Well, he was born in the land too, before the captivity. Haggai might have been 80 years old. Zechariah probably 30 years old. There's two generations between these, you see. And you've got an old prophet and a young prophet because you've got one generation in the ecclesia against another generation in the ecclesia. And God sends in two prophets to specifically address the problem that had allowed the Samaritans to win the day. Well, they address it all right. And the temple is completed in Ezra chapter 6. Remarkable, isn't it? Absolutely remarkable. Well, come with me now to Zechariah chapter 1. I'm just going to open up a couple of verses of this chapter and then we finish. Zechariah chapter 1. What about Zechariah's prophecy? We looked at Haggai. Let me just show you one or two points from Zechariah before we close. Here's what the prophecy of Zechariah looks like by way of overview. There are 14 chapters. And the prophecy essentially splits into two halves. The first half, from chapter 1 to 8, the dated prophecies of Zechariah, that is those prophecies which have dates, the year that they were given, recorded amongst them. In the second half, from chapter 9 to 14, the undated prophecies of Zechariah. And in a very general sense, the dated prophecies, the first eight chapters, relate to the immediate future of the Jews in the land. Yes, there are dual applications to the visions of Zechariah that relate to the future. But there were immediate applications to those visions which related to the day as well. Then chapters 19 and 11, prophecies of the near future. Alexander the Great, for example. The scattering of the flock in AD 70. Near future, in the next, say, 500 years. And in chapter 10, the consequences of that. And then, of course, chapters 12 through 14, prophecies relating to the distant future, Armageddon, from the Jewish, from the Gentile point of view. Now that's a rough analysis, but it's useful just to see the difference between the prophecies and those that were dated and those that weren't. Now look at verse 1 of Zechariah chapter 1. In the eighth month, in the second year of Darius, came the word of Yahweh to Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo, the prophet. It's interesting, you know. Zechariah is the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo. Haggai told the people that if they put their hearts into the building of the house of God, that God would bless them. Zechariah tells us exactly the same thing in the very first verse of his prophecy. How? How does Zechariah say that? Because this is a chronological verse. Well, this is how he says it. Zechariah means Yah hath remembered. Zechariah, Yah. Yah hath remembered. Berechiah. Yah hath blessed. Iddo, at the appointed time. And you can run those together, you see, and they make a logical sentence. That Yahweh has remembered and Yahweh has blessed at the appointed time. What do you suppose the appointed time was? Answer, 516 BC. The completion of the 70 years destruction of the temple. That was why this prophet came on the scene. To ensure with Haggai that temple was completed on time. At the completion of the second 70-year period. This was the blessing that would come at the appointed time. You'll appreciate if they hadn't come on the scene. I mean, it did take 4 years to finish the thing once they began to get involved. If they had never got involved, it would never have been completed on time. Probably never been completed at all. There was the blessing, you see. A blessing from Haggai, and you can see in those names, a blessing from Zechariah. This is how Zechariah introduces himself. And the great lesson from Zechariah's prophecy, verse 2. Yahweh hath been sore displeased with your fathers. Therefore say thou unto them, thus saith Yahweh of armies, turn unto me, saith Yahweh of armies, and I will turn unto you, saith Yahweh of armies. There was Zechariah's message to his people. You return back to God, and God will return to you. You continue building your own houses and living your merry, sweet lives the way you have, and God will do anything but turn to you. He'll curse everything you touch. But you return to him, and he'll return to you. And verse 6, he says, but my words and my statutes, which have commanded my servants the prophets, they did not take hold of your fathers. And they returned and said, like as Yahweh of armies thought to do to us according to our ways and according to our doings, so hath he dealt with us. Now this phrase here, in the middle of the verse, that they not take hold of your fathers, the margin has overtake. And the point of the verse is that God's prophecies overtook their fathers because their fathers didn't heed the word of God. Zechariah is simply saying, learn the lesson of a former generation. Don't repeat the folly of your fathers. Return to me and I will return to you, says God, and bless you. Brothers, sisters, young people, we're living at the end of the age. Not the end of an age, we're living at the end of the age, in the very shadow of the return of the Lord Jesus Christ. As I said at the outset, it's history screaming it, prophecy screaming it, the headlines of the news media are screaming it. Very soon the Master's going to come, he's going to replace the temporal with the eternal. Until then, we're living, as Zechariah speaks it, we're living in a day of small things. Our building work, frankly, is puny compared with the building work that we conducted, be it physically or spiritually, in the age to come. As we continue our series on the prophecy of Zechariah, therefore, let's rally to the cry of the prophet. Let's learn the lesson of former generations of Jews. Build the house of God, that when the Master does come, he might say to us, well done, good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I, therefore, will make thee ruler over many things.